We have Rabbi Lori Zimmerman. Rabbi Zimmerman was educated at University of Wisconsin. She was ordained by the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College outside of Philadelphia. It's interesting that she has been involved in all kinds of volunteer work, a lot of it social justice, including the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice, Refusers Solidarity Network, Rabbis for Human Rights, and did I leave something out? Madison Jewish Community Council. And she is presently, she also has interned at a number of organizations. She was rabbinic intern for Rabbis for Human Rights and also for the Greater Philadelphia Progressive Clergy. And she is presently the rabbi at Congregation Shaarei Shamayim here in Madison. And now I'd like to invite Rabbi Zimmerman to speak to us.
Thank you for the invitation to be here today. In the first chapter of the book of Genesis, God declares, "Let us make humans in our image after our form." The Talmudic commentary is sensitive to the nuances of the text. The rabbis ask, why does it say us? To whom is God speaking? They write that God was asking the advice of four angels: the angel of love, the angel of justice, the angel of peace, and the angel of truth, about whether to create Adam, the first human being. The angel of love says to God, "Let him be created, because he will perform acts of kindness." The angel of truth responded, "Let him not be created. He will be full of lies." The angel of justice countered, "Let him be created, because he will do righteous deeds." But the angel of peace retorted, "Let him not be created, because he will create only war." God was faced with a hung jury: two angels in favor of creating human beings and two against. So what did God do? God took the angel of truth and hurled it to the ground, thereby creating a 2-to-1 majority in favor of bringing human beings into the world. The question then arises, if God had to decide to hurl either truth or peace into the ground to create the desired vote count, why does God choose truth? Perhaps it is because peace is extremely fragile. If it is not continually protected, it can be shattered forever. Truth, however, is a different matter. Even if it is seemingly destroyed and it splinters into millions of pieces, it will eventually spring forth from the ground. When we engage in dialogue, we each bring our own individual pieces of truth to the table. And while our ultimate beliefs are different, we gather at a conference like this in order to learn from one another. Religious communities are extraordinarily complex, and we should not underestimate our differences, both among our communities and also within our communities. Indeed, internal disagreements can be volatile, and the discussions among people of the same religion can be uglier than disagreements across religions. We are not monolithic, and none of us can speak for all Jews, all Christians, or all Muslims. This makes it challenging when we reach out across religious lines, for difficult decisions must be made about whom we talk to and work with. How we are perceived both internally and externally becomes an important question when the discourse becomes public. We encounter each other in diverse environments: at interfaith events, neighborhood meetings, political forums, at the university, formal dialogue sessions, and places of worship. Keenly aware of the public nature of these gatherings, they often entail pleasant interactions, polite conversation, and general messages of support. Often we gloss over our differences so as not to offend each other, choosing to remain on the safe terrain of highlighting how similar we are to each other. At times, however, tense confrontations erupt between religious communities. A thorny political issue emerges in the city. a controversial movie comes to town. A prominent religious leader generates hostility and hatred towards another group. Our differences are exacerbated, and previous suspicions and distrust explode into outrage. The rabbinic commentary on Genesis provides us with wisdom about how to approach these complex relationships. It teaches that peace, because it is so fragile, must be guarded and cared for at all times. The relationships that we build among our communities must be continually monitored and protected. If we are so polite that we can never get to know each other, or our discourse becomes so bitter that we sever ties among our communities, this peace cannot be preserved. Truth, however, is much more resilient. When we engage with each other honestly and forthrightly, and we genuinely seek to explore our similarities and differences with the purpose of learning from each other, we will recover when we hurt or offend each other. We will grow from this engagement, and our communities will be the better for it. The philosopher Martin Buber, in his work I and Thou, offers an important insight into how our communities might relate to one another. He writes, "True dialogue expresses an essential aspect of the human spirit. When we listen and respond to one another with an authenticity that forges a bond between us. When we reach out to others with honesty, openness, and humility, we express this essential aspect of the human spirit. So too, when we build trust, friendship, and confidence, when we approach another with a true desire to learn, and when we genuinely respect ideas which differ from our own. Dialogue at its best gives us the opportunity to share the passion and depth of our own beliefs while also seeking to understand and learn from others' beliefs. An essential component of speaking with each other is being willing to critique our own religious traditions and communities. When we move beyond politeness and really engage with each other, we are often eager to critique others. We forget that our own traditions hold problematic ideologies towards other religions and adherents of those religions. Exclusivist truth claims can easily, if not necessarily, result in depicting the other as a heathen, infidel, idolater, or heretic. If we alone hold divine truth, and if others do not accept it, then there must be something immoral, if not sinister, about those non-believers. Moreover, we must acknowledge and take responsibility for the acts of violence that our communities have perpetrated towards others. We cannot assume that what is past is past. Historical events continue to shape present relationships. And if we are to understand the other and chart a new path for better relations, then we must deal with these historical events. If we deny, rationalize, or justify atrocities, we can never hope to build sustainable relationships across religious lines. We must confront the dark side of our religious traditions and our community's deeds. Professor Leah Katali Takim, in his article From Conversion to Conversation, Interfaith Dialogue in Post-9/11 America, aptly explains this essential precursor for successful interfaith relationships. He writes, "One of the major obstacles to reaching an understanding of the other is when we compare our ideals with the realities of the other. Viewed in this context, the violence perpetrated by members of one party is often contrasted with the ideals of peace and love of the other. A more appropriate basis of comparison is to contrast our ideals with theirs, or our realities with the realities of those with whom we dialogue. When communities compare their respective realities, they often discover that both of them have been unjust to the other, and in the name of religion, have committed atrocious acts. Indeed, disputes between groups often arise when one party believes that it is the only injured group or victim and refuses to accept its role in the conflict. Some atrocities are worse than others, and some peoples have been persecuted more than others. We need not draw meaningless parallels between our communities and argue that we have all been oppressors and we have all been oppressed. Therefore, we should simply move on. By comparing ideals to ideals and realities to realities, we can better learn who the other is, how their experiences have shaped their communities, and why they believe what they believe. There's a troubling tendency in religious communities to dehumanize the other, and we therefore must be honest about our religious traditions and take responsibility when our communities cause harm to others. This act of taking responsibility is predicated on being able to see that our traditions and our communities are not flawless. Belief that we are more righteous or our past is beyond reproach makes our dialogue lack integrity. That being said, we should not be so determined to befriend the other that we are overly self-critical and that we censor our beliefs. We do not want to romanticize others instead of seeing them as real people who are capable of making poor decisions and not always living up to their ideals. To do this can be just as problematic as acting as if we are superior, for it does not seek to see others as they really are, but as we want them to be in our own imaginations. We need to hold ourselves accountable and push our dialogue partners to do the same so that we can strive for authentic dialogue based on mutual risk. We now come to the question of whether it is ever appropriate to critique other people's religious ideas and practices. We are quick to judge and disparage others, but too often our critiques are based on incomplete or erroneous ideas. It is exceedingly easy to misinterpret practices which we know nothing or little about. In critiquing others' practices, we often impose our own assumptions and evaluate them through our own lenses and with our own biases. We have no direct familiarity with these practices, as we are only looking in from the outside. Our discourse becomes self-righteous, and we are unable to appreciate or even recognize the nuances of the belief or practice. There are plenty of religious beliefs and practices that need to be rethought and reconstructed. Yet the people best prepared to make those critiques are the very people who are part of those traditions and communities. They are the ones who can understand the discourse, who can speak to their lived experience, and who possess some credibility with which to make change. It is not an outsider's place to create internal change in another's community. However, an exception to this is when a belief or practice is used to harm others. We have a right and responsibility to challenge the violence being committed in religion's name, in our communities and outside of them. The most effective way to pose the challenge is to create alliances with people from those very religious communities who share our critique. It is then that we can work together as allies and across religious lines for the greater good of the society. Another challenge with asking communities to critique each other is that each group does not share equal power. In the United States, the American Jewish and American Muslim communities each comprise less than 2% of the population. Both communities are keenly aware that we live in a Christian country and live according to the norms of the dominant religion. Moreover, we struggle with discrimination directed towards our communities and fear the erosion of religious freedoms in this country. Jews and Muslims do have significant demographic differences. Even though Jews and Muslims are roughly equal in size in the U.S. population, Jews are a tiny minority in the world. And although the vast majority of the Jewish and Muslim populations immigrated to the U.S. in the past 125 years, the major waves of Jewish immigration preceded the major waves of Muslim immigration by several decades. These facts, as well as many others, produce different realities for our communities and are important to recognize as we engage in dialogues and create alliances with one another. The differences in power matter when we talk to each other. They shade our perceptions, reactions, and responses to societal affairs. They lead us to hold different assumptions and draw different conclusions based on what power we have at any given moment in any given place. Unless we acknowledge differences in power and seek to understand why one community might choose to respond more quickly to an issue or be more reticent to respond to an issue, we talk past each other and continue to misunderstand our respective communities. So far, I've been talking about the importance of dialogue and community building and the complexities of critiquing ourselves and each other. To have these kinds of conversations, I have presumed that all parties are equally committed to sincere and respectful conversation. I would now like to address the issue of talking to each other when there is not a spirit of friendship, when we do not, as Buber wrote, listen and respond to one another with an authenticity that forges a bond between us. We often encounter people from other religious communities who want to talk to us only to accost us, to show us how bitterly they disagree with us, or to demonstrate the inferiority of our belief systems. It is always a choice whether we decide to engage with a particular person or organization. And there are obviously times when it does not make sense to speak together. When the discourse is so caustic, when there's no opportunity for mutual understanding, and when there are significant risks involved, it is legitimate to decide not to sit down at the table together. If someone is actively trying to convert me, for example, I would not be interested in pursuing the relationship. My concern, however, is that we avoid this engagement all too often. We may believe that unless the other person is similar enough to us, espouses our values, political ideologies, or goals, then we should not engage with them. The purpose of dialogue, however, is to talk to precisely the people with whom we disagree. As the Midrash pointed out, peace is fragile. We must find ways of living together in a multicultural, multi-faith, globalized society. I do not believe that we have to give up our own beliefs, even if they include exclusivist claims to truth, in order to engage in dialogue. In theologian Harvey Cox's article, Many Mansions or One Way, The Crisis in Interfaith Dialogue, he illustrates this particularly well. He writes, "I count myself as one of the universalists, yet sometimes, as I have sat in genteel or even mildly acrimonious gatherings of urbane representatives of different faith traditions under the auspices of the World Council of Churches or the Center for the Study of World Religions at Harvard, my mind has strayed to from the conference room out to those jagged corners of the world where other confessors of these same faiths are killing or proselytizing, or just frigidly ignoring one another. I've wondered at such moments whether the dialogue has not become a tedious exercise in preaching to the converted, and I have secretly wished to bring in some of those enthusiasts, deprived of the energy such particularists embody, a dialogue among the urbane can, and sometimes does, deteriorate into a repetitious exchange of vacuities. It could end with a whimper. Polite discourse is perhaps more comfortable than bitter disagreement, but a refusal to engage with, in Cox's words, the particularists, means that our conversations will lack the vigor that they need to ultimately survive. It is challenging to speak with people who are unwilling to critique themselves and who are quick to judge others, and it is sometimes not possible to speak with people who do not respect the diversity of religious practice. However, we do not have to agree with each other, nor do we have to become friends. We do have to figure out, however, how to communicate with each other, understand each other, become more sensitive to the needs of the other, and ultimately live together. I will conclude by saying that I am a pluralist. I believe that we not only have different legitimate paths, but that we also hold different ultimate truths. God splinters truth into many pieces. We each hold different pieces, and when we come together for dialogue, we broaden and deepen each of our truths. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank our panelists for three excellent presentations. And before we go to questions, I'm just going to start on this side and move to the right, which Jews have been doing now for some time. I just want to emphasize what I think were three central points that were made by our panelists. The first by Dr. Abdallah is the humility that we need to have in the face of other traditions and to understand that we can never fully understand a tradition that is not our own. Bishop Morlino spoke of the need to be honest about what is not negotiable about our own traditions and the importance of being accepting of what is non-negotiable in other traditions. And finally, Rabbi Zimmerman spoke of the importance of honest self-reflection and looking at the problematic aspects of one's own tradition before criticizing others. So let's begin with questions. Anyone on this side here wants to?
From my point of view, I'm on the left. But it gets to the point that I'd like to make, and that is, it seems to me that an underlying principle of all the speakers was that people have rights in this discussion. In other words, they come to the discussion with rights. And I always feel more comfortable when people come to a discussion or come to a place with obligations. So as a Jew, the way that translates, if I am sitting in a place where there's a Muslim and a Catholic who really would like to proselytize and convert me from my Judaism to something else, then I'd rather not be in a position that I have a right to be Jewish, but rather be in a situation in which they're obliged not to proselytize me. And I think that if that approach were adopted, in other words, rights versus obligations, maybe for non-lawyers that's it's a subtle difference, but it is a substantial difference as to who, in an obligation society, you have to control yourself as opposed to controlling a third person as to what they do. You have to control your own conduct as opposed to controlling somebody else's conduct. And it would seem to me that in a dialogue among three faiths, Abrahamic faiths, that as a first principle would be a good one. The second good principle, I think, or basic principle, I think we heard last night from Rabbi Hirschfield, who articulated the view that, I hope I get this right, the omnipotence of God cannot be confined to one of our traditions or faiths, that the idea of God is so large that each of us looks at it from a certain perspective and then brings to the understanding of who and what God is from our own tradition, leaving a variety of perspectives to that understanding and to that discussion. So I just ask if there are any reactions to that. I realize that it's really not a question, but an observation.
My response to that would be that that's the kind of thing that I had in mind in talking about adab, basic courtesy, and the fact that that interfaith, in my belief, if it's going to succeed, is essentially a type of culture, and that culture would involve things like obligations. I think one of the problems with Abrahamic discourse is that what happens to atheists, what happens to Buddhists, Taoists, and others, I mean, we all have to agree to be friends. And I think that for monotheists in interfaith, we're sort of henotheists. And, you know, the henotheist is the person who might be a polytheist, but when they worship Vishnu or Amun-Ra or whoever it is, they become monotheists. So in our own faith communities, we're in a complete faith universe where this is it. But I think in the community discourse, then there is this sort of, like, you have your space, I have my space, and there has to be, you know. And I think, again, the Islamic paradigm of toleration is very good, because in Islamic toleration, faith communities are protected despite the fact that they're believed to be wrong. And there's a famous example of that, of a Magian community that was, faith community, protected community. And the Muslim judge was told that they have incestuous marriages. So will they be allowed to do that? And his response was yes, because that's their faith. So I think that, you know, giving each community its space and maybe having that sort of henotheistic approach to our own, I think it's a good type of culture to develop.
Your comment, by the way, reminds me of a line from a book by A. Roy Eckhart, who was a Christian thinker who was heavily involved in interfaith dialogue. He said, "Jews have a great deal to learn from Christians about love, and Christians have a great deal to learn from Jews about responsibility." Whether it's true, or, I mean, it's obviously an oversimplification, but even oversimplifications may have truth to them. You have a question? Yes. Okay.
And I'm sorry to have to say this, but I was very disturbed when that prayer came back, and I know in Latin that the translation is different, but not everybody knows Latin. In fact, few people know Latin. And it talked about the perfidious Jews, and that has a very negative connotation in English. And that kind of thing worries me, because as a child I was a victim of Catholic anti-Semitism, and it was very, very difficult. And we were talking about obligations, and I think personally that one has to be very careful. I know tradition is wonderful, and I can understand wanting to bring back traditions, but I think one has to be very careful when one does bring back traditions, is that it doesn't involve somebody else and it doesn't hurt someone else.
Well, I would just say that when we brought that traditional mass back, that prayer was changed. The word perfidious was taken out, and the references to blindness were taken out. That was the first thing that was done, precisely for the reasons that you recommend. And the the new wording in Latin, so the old wording in Latin was taken out, and the new wording was put in that they might be, that the Jewish people might see the light of Christ. But given that we believe that that's the best thing that could ever happen to anybody, of course we would pray for that. And I think that there are ways in which Jewish people lovingly pray for Gentiles, which we might not completely find agreement with, but it's fine, because you're praying that you want the best that you believe there is for us, and we're praying that we want the best in terms of what we believe for you. But that negative language was taken out of there.
I'm glad to hear that, because I really don't, it doesn't matter to me what people believe that much. What bothers me is when it affects someone else, especially we're talking about the power relationship. I was a victim of it as a child, and I wouldn't want my children or grandchildren to have to go through that type of thing again.
No, and I... Well, I would say that the Pope's gesture in going to the synagogue in New York was much more important than whatever here. But I mean, that particular thing was taken out of there and fixed as best as we could fix it immediately. But not to everyone's satisfaction, and that's really what I was getting at. But I know there's been terrible hurt, and I certainly empathize with that hurt, and I don't want any of our people, I don't want there to be Catholic or any other kind of anti-Semitism anywhere.
Yes.
Yeah, I think maybe someone has a mic. Does this turn on the microphone?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if everyone could, if you look, if the little red lights on, you might turn it off because there's some feedback here, so I don't know if someone actually turned on their mic. Just following up on this, I really... you know, you spoke about the golden rule, and in the Islamic traditions comes from a statement of the Prophet Muhammad, none of you believes until you love for your brother what you love for yourself. So belief is faith itself is tied to that love for the other. And when prayers are a very difficult thing, because on the one hand you're praying to God, but on the other hand, as soon as you articulate it out loud, you are now saying those words in a historical context, a context, social context in which there are power dimensions. And so a private prayer between you and God is something, but a public prayer cannot escape from those power relations. And I think here we have to think about what we would love for the other. And certainly in this world we would want security, that the other to feel safe and secure. And I think that's where it becomes very difficult, because we all in our traditions have both private and public prayers. But I think this comes to where, these particular situations are difficult. I know with the baptism of Maggie Adam, for example, the biggest problem was not the fact that he was baptized, it's that he was the most vociferous demeaning. I look at the statement about derision of religious beliefs, he was absolutely hostile, demeaning, belligerent when it came to Islam and Muslims, even to the point where 200 Italian academics a few years ago wrote that he, asking that he stop using his position as a newspaper publisher or editor to attack Muslims, who are, after all, a small minority in Italy, who mostly are very marginal socially, laborers who don't have, any rights, very little rights. So the problem is that when someone like that is elevated in a in a real world context. And this is, I'm not going to say it only has to do with Catholics. This is what I'm just throwing out is that we have to somehow, I think, the Abrahamic traditions, we need to think about our prayers and what it sounds. Maybe some of the prayers that Jews say for the land of Israel might, you know, Palestinians in a real world context hear it in a certain way, or when Muslims pray about non-Muslims again, there is a power dynamic. So I don't know how to solve it, but it's, I would say that it's an area that needs to be explored more deeply.
Very interesting point. You remind me of a teaching of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who said, most people worry about other people's spiritual well-being and their own material well-being. He said, wouldn't it be wonderful if it were the other way around? In any case, I have a question for you, Bishop Morlino, but I'd like to preface it by saying, in the spirit of Rabbi Zimmerman's remarks, that it is rarely noted, but it should be, that up to the second century and possibly beyond, according to the latest scholarship, Judaism was a proselytizing religion as well. And it's not entirely clear what all the reasons are that Judaism decided not to become a proselytizing religion, but that's just a datum that I think ought to be on the table. My question for you, Bishop Morlino, is this. Given your position that the best thing that could happen to non-Catholics would be to accept Jesus and to become Catholics, what then do you see as the purpose of dialogue between Catholics and non-Catholics? And I guess specifically, can Catholics learn anything from other religious traditions? Not just saying, oh, you know, he's a nice guy, but something substantive from other religious traditions.
In a word, absolutely. But what I was trying to say, the way that's going to happen is if we have some substantial, not least common denominator sort, but substantial common ground. And I think the real issue is the connection between faith and reason for our dialogue, and the importance of common starting points of reason, so that we can, and that's how I think we learn things. Because I think it's very difficult when we just start with denominational convictions that we have, because then it's either we'll take it or leave it. But if we started to say, well, there are arguments by which someone can know that God exists, who is this God? And we could talk about how one comes to know who this God is. And I think we could learn a lot from each other if we started that way. And we could then ask the question, well, how do I get to where I got, and how do you get to where you got? How do we do that? But we both say, according to reason, that God exists. We don't believe that God exists. We know it. And I think that the truth issue is the most difficult issue for our dialogue, not the faith conviction issue. Because we live in a culture which is very reluctant to admit objective truth for everyone, then I don't know what we do when we dialogue. That, to me, is the threat for dialogue. I mean, the fact that I believe that the best thing that could happen to anybody would be to meet Jesus Christ risen from the dead, well, I would have no integrity if I said anything other than that. But I don't think that's the problem. I think the problem is, can we have a dialogue based on reason, which people trust to correct error and to lead to the truth of reason? And let's just work at it from that point of view for a while and see what happens. The real destroyer, the real derailer of dialogue is this relativism in which our country is enmeshed, because somebody thinks the only truth that's true objectively is that there is no truth. And then we go from there. And you don't go anywhere from there. That's an act of faith. No one could ever prove that there is no truth. To say there is no truth is an act of faith that introduces one into some kind of a religion. And I think that's the derailer and the threat to dialogue, not my conviction about what would be best for everyone or the conviction of a devout Islamic person about what would be best or the conviction of a devout Jew. But I don't think that's the derailer of dialogue at all. I think the derailer of dialogue is this faith-based relativism, faith-based skepticism. The faith being, I choose to believe that there is no truth, because that's an act of faith, not an act of reason. So I think that's where the issue is in terms of what derails dialogue, myself.
But what if reason leads one to radical skepticism?
I think that's a contradiction in terms, myself. Because if someone were to engage in reason, they would be convinced that it didn't lead there. I don't think logic can lead to radical skepticism, because radical skepticism means A and not A are both true at the same time in the same respect, and logic can't lead there under any circumstances, I would say.
Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
This may sound simplistic, but it seems to me that there is room in God's world, God's universe. We can't all see all of God at all times, And so there are maybe many different truths that are very true. They can't necessarily contradict each other, but it reminds me of looking at an elephant from 2 inches away, and boy, you know exactly what's in front of your face, and you would say, and this is an elephant, and I know it because I see it, and it's, you know, much more tactile than our physical eyes. But isn't it possible that it isn't relativism necessarily, but many different ways of looking truth about that?
Well, sure, but they're perspectives. If you're speaking to me, they're perspectives.
Okay, anybody, yeah.
They're perspectives, but and I wouldn't say that there is any one person who is completely in possession of the whole truth in the here and now. We're all, but there is one truth. There is one, and there are obvious. You know, it's a datum of experience that there are different journeys to that truth. I wouldn't deny that at all. But is there a one universal truth to which we are moving by reason? That's my only.
But can one individual, even one faith tradition, describe the whole truth?
If I could respond to that from an Islamic standpoint, within my tradition, which also has a Sufi tradition, from the standpoint of Ibn Arabi, every person is true. Every human being, not even every denomination, has truth. And that's on the level of what he calls aqd, which is construction. And aqidah, which is creed, is something totally different. So each person is judged by their construction. And that construction on reality is true. It is correct. But you have different levels of truth. So some are more true than others. And the highest truth is the magnanimous. It's the great soul that embodies the whole perfection of humanity. So there is an ultimate truth. And that's the truth of the prophets and of the greatest of human beings, the saints and so forth. But in fact, every aspect of reality is truth.
Well, I talked about what I believe about truth. I think we all have different pieces of it, and that I guess I fundamentally don't understand how someone could say that my truth is wrong or incorrect, or I mean, my truth is rooted in my experience. I am an American Jew. All sorts of things that who I am, my experience has led me to formulate a whole set of ideas. I'm influenced by all sorts of different things. And so it doesn't make sense to say that I am, that any one person has an exclusivist claim to that truth, I guess. Maybe I'll say more later. But.
I'd like to bring back the focus to the word perfidious. Perfidious Jews that you mentioned in the prayer. If it was taken out, it's because it was first of all in. I think it was in for centuries. And what it was in was the Latin liturgy. And therefore it was the Latin liturgy approved by the Pope. Therefore it was approved by a series of Pope after Pope after Pope after Pope. They all liked it. So what was the responsibility of Catholics at that time? I think it was to stand up and tell the Pope, you are in error. If it's an error today, it was an error back then.
I would just say that the word was perfidies, iudaeis perfidies. Now, if you just look at perfidies, that sounds like perfidious. But what that word really means in Latin is that the Jews who obviously don't have our faith in Jesus Christ is what it means. But I think probably in those days they probably knew that. It was, I think, unfortunate that we got. We have in our church, if you haven't, I mean, if anybody reads, they know, so we have a lot of problems about translations. Big, big problems.
In the context,
and we always have.
Yes. In the context of the centuries when this was in the liturgy, it could have also been understood as perfidious because there was a context of extreme hostility and negation and condemnation of Jews and Judaism from the Catholic Church.
There was certainly a lot, and there still is, a lot of sin in the Catholic Church to this day because there are a lot of sinners in the Catholic Church, myself included.
Popes included.
Popes are sinners, oh, some of them were champions. some of them were varsity. But that, you know, that becomes another.
Yeah.
I don't want to do this, but I have to celebrate Mass at 5:00. So I'm sorry for that. It's been wonderful to be with you all, and I really enjoy this give and take, but turned out my schedule today was tight, and so please excuse me, and thank you very much. It was great to be with you. Thank you very much.
Okay. It's been some years since I took Latin. Omnia Gallia, etc. And so, as people talked about perfidious, there's a phrase, the perfidious Albion. Does anyone remember where that comes from?
Perfidious Albion. Perfidious. Where is Perfidious Albion?
It's a 16th, 17th century general European attack. I think it's probably Spanish-centered when Spain and England were mortal enemies vying for imperial domination. And, everybody felt that the other party was lying, deceitful, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the phrase that stuck for the English.
And in my mind.
Yes.
Then to get to what I really wanted to ask about was, I thought that we've been talking about very individual behavior in this conference. I think you all need to talk about very individual behavior because as Americans, that's how we're brought up. And so I like very much what you had to say, that you were Jewish and you were starting on the left, and that in an obligation society, you must control your own behavior. And I thought again that is preferable to me than to talk about a righteous society where everybody is supreme as an individual. And I wondered if you wouldn't embroider on that obligation society and what it means in a context of today's politics, because that's what we're really talking about.
Well, in all honesty and humility, I'm not on the panel, so I think it's appropriate to look at the individuals who are.
I can say something. I really appreciate that. I think that was very helpful to think about rights versus obligations. And when I was preparing, I think one of the things I thought about, I didn't articulate it as obligation, but I actually think it's really helpful to do that, is that we have an obligation to critique our own communities and ourselves. I mean, I think that's a given, and a real obligation. And I wasn't, unfortunately, there last night, but Orach told me that our speaker said something about that for all of us here, we're doing good stuff, but we have to go an extra 10%. I think that's actually a really helpful obligation, and that we're holding ourselves and each other accountable to a certain set of standards and values, and that... And we call each other on it in constructive ways, but that we're committed to living up to those ideals, and I think that could just be a very helpful way of framing dialogue. Yeah.
Does that help explain why so many on the left are Jews?
That's a really big question.
That's a different conference.
I would like to know from the two remaining panelists a little bit more about though the third panelist who left us now has brought it in about the non-negotiables. Yeah, in this dialogue, we can do this dialogue as kind of a matter of, you know, we are all enlightened in a way, and toleration and the common good and the community will benefit if we all are peaceful with each other. But I want to know from you as religious people, as leaders of a religious community, what drives you? What's the idea, or what would be after critically assessing your own tradition, understanding yourself critically in your own tradition, also with reflecting back on your own tradition, how can we find out about what are the non-negotiables to divide us? But what is it? What do we have as non-negotiables to bring us together? So I kind of a little bit more towards that platform we might or might not have, or we have, but maybe I don't know. Is it narrow? Is it big? I would like to for you to respond to that.
Well, I think that, as I said, in the Islamic tradition, you have to begin with definition. And definition also includes purpose. So what is the purpose of interfaith dialogue? Is it to create a new religion? Is it an act of spirituality? In other words, that we're going to worship together? I mean, if that's the case, then let's say that's what it is. Or is it, you know, to live together as human beings, you know, with a certain culture of respect, understanding that we come from very solid traditions that in certain ways are uncompromising. And I would say that the latter is the reasonable position, because if interfaith is going to be of value, then it really needs to bring in the people who are not here. And like I would say that most of the people here probably were very tolerant, were very open-minded people. And I'd be happy to discuss anything that you want to spiritually or theologically. I'm totally open to that. But, you know, if you talk about the communities that we represent, the very essence of their being is that we have the truth. And, you know, this is the priest who was here just now, I mean, this is also his position, that there's no relativism. So I think that it's very important to recognize the integrity of the other faiths. Now, issues about hurting other people and so forth, all of these things, even what we believe, are very valid topics of discussion. But that has to be done in an arena that's fair and that's open. And I think, again, that has certain obligations. I don't like my tradition to be defined. I don't like my history to be defined for me. But I think that the main thing is, like, what are we doing? What are we intending to do? To worship together? And again, to me, what do you do about atheists? What do you do about secularists? What do you do about Buddhists and Taoists and Confucianists and animists and other people? I mean, we don't tolerate them. I think that the basic humanism of the project is really what's essential, and it's to sort of remove the poison that is there in interfaith dialogue so that we can live together.
So in a really practical sense, I think for me the non-negotiable, and I know this is a controversial thing, but is people not trying to convert me. I just don't know how you do dialogue when someone's actively trying to convert me, or when we're trying to convert somebody else. I think the few other things is that I want people to understand that my tradition is not monolithic. And I really resonated with what you said about we can't speak for each other. I can study Islam, but I'm not a Muslim. I can't speak for Muslim people. And I think we get ourselves into a lot of trouble when we do that. So I also think that's a non-negotiable. And I guess the last thing I would say is that I want people to understand that my truths are legitimate. And that, again, what I'd said before is that I think that there are multiple truths. And that we recognize that there are many paths. And when that being said, I do think that I can still talk to somebody who believes that I have that Jesus Christ is my savior, and even somebody who has a hope that one day that I will follow Jesus Christ. I think that's different from someone actively trying to convert you. And so I think the belief is certainly I don't appreciate that, but I'm happy to sit down at the table with someone to talk about that.
Yes.
I had the privilege last year as an Orthodox Christian priest to be invited to give a presentation at a mosque. And I found that I could speak of many parallels between Christianity and Muslim and Judaism, and the whole idea of a compassionate, merciful, and loving God. And I think there's something that we have very much in common there. I got most in trouble at the presentation with my own people of my own religion, it went very, very well, and I felt very close to my Muslim brothers and sisters. But what happened was, we have a theology of forgiveness, which I think also is common to Judaism and Yom Kippur and Ramadan and Muslim. But I proceeded to explain that probably the greatest atrocities was committed by the Western nations in the United States. And the biggest one, this happened to be just a few days after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I says, we're the ones that use weapons of mass destruction. And I said that we Christians, I would like to apologize because I think we have to ask forgiveness for what we do, especially in the Middle East for the atrocities that we use what we call smart weaponry, it's really doing violence over there. And I think that we need to ask forgiveness as Christians. And what happened was, the Greeks came back to me and says, you can't say that because the Turks have to apologize to the Byzantine Christians for what they did in Asia Minor. But I think as Christians, we need to give the example of first asking forgiveness. Now, another thing that I've found that the relationship with the other Christians, with Muslims and so and Jews, I think there's also they're asking us questions, also explaining their views, also refines and even embellishes our understanding of our own tradition, because I think there's so much we have in common. The tradition that I combat, Orthodox tradition, is kind of out of the Russian tradition, but here in America, we have a tradition of the Russian emigres going to Paris, encountering Western culture, and then teaching in our seminaries. Our major seminary is St. Vladimir's in Crestwood outside of New York City. And we have such men as George Frodowski, Mindar, and Schmemann, who have this engagement with the Western culture. And I think also the Roman Catholic Church, I hope I'm not giving the whole presentation, but the Roman Catholic Church took on Thomistic Aristotelian philosophy. And if I'm not mistaken, that Thomas Aquinas got the Aristotle from Arabic sources. So you see here a borrowing coming into a major Western Christian tradition, and since the Council of Trent all the way to Vatican II, Thomas Aquinas was a major thing, and his literature was from Aristotle coming through, I think, Arabic literature.
In my professional life, there's a method by which we inquire into each other, which we call appreciative inquiry. I find myself during the course of today, most especially with the Muslim scholars and Imam and so on, finding myself stumped as to how to commence an appreciative inquiry without insulting inadvertently, because I find that my differences of worldview and construction of reality are most thwarting of connection. So I ask whether or not we could change the subject a little bit and practice learning how to teach the other to ask appropriately, because I don't think that I'm equipped, and I think I need equipping, and I need permission to ask for that kind of equipping. Perhaps I should be just as humble in the presence of my Jewish brothers and sisters, and I know for sure in the presence of fundamentalist Christians, I need that equipping because I'm really poor at that. But I wonder if anyone else has felt that. We look for ways in which we're similar, and I don't really care about whether we're similar or not. I just want to find out. And what the results are ought to be left up to the results of the inquiry, not for some agenda wherein I have this secret little wormy hope that we're more similar than we are different. I don't particularly care if we're really different. I would like that just fine if I knew how to ask better.
Do you think that I agree with you or disagree? Or do you care? Right.
Is that a sincere question?
Yeah, that's authenticity, right?
I think from what you presented that you would be comfortable with that kind of question.
I am. Yeah.
And I think you would be.
I feel it's my point of view. I just wondered if you thought it was.
Well, it's mine.
But I think it's very important that we get to know each other. It's very important to know what we believe. It's very important to know about things like the rabbinic tradition, and you know the other traditions of the other faiths. That's really important. I mean, I taught comparative religion for 16 years. I think that's an essential study. But what's also important is that as much as you learn about a faith, and I've studied a great deal about the different faiths, you still don't have the ability to judge the tradition. I mean, Buddhism or Confucianism, whatever it is. I think it's very valuable for us to note the many things we have in common. And we have tremendous things in common. I think also it's very important for people in religious discourse not to take themselves too seriously. That we ascribe a lot of things to religion that may have nothing to do with it. For example, Islam and Christianity in the Middle Ages, they have almost the same worldview. They differ on things like the Trinity. But other than that, they have very similar worldview. And in fact, they were sort of too close for comfort. But what was it that caused the big problem between the Roman Catholic Church and between Islam? It's geopolitics. Because they have the same strategic interests. They're like Rome and Persia. So they are competing. And this is one of the reasons why the Orthodox tradition tended to be much more favorable, because it was actually conquered. So the Orthodox Church lived under the toleration of the state, but they didn't have that geopolitical interest. So that's geopolitics. I mean, so if we're going to talk about the problems of the world, you know, we have to avoid this compartmentalization of contemporary thought, you know, that like we just talk about religion here, we talk geopolitics here. You know, I mean, if we're going to talk about what's happening in the world, what people do with religion, then of course there's a lot more than religion to be talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
I wanted to comment on that because I really like that question. One of the most helpful books that I've read in trying to understand how difficult it is to escape your own, the imposition of your own worldview on another, by reading a book called The Tao of Islam. So it was by a Japanese woman who said, you know, so often we hear about Islam and gender in Islam from a Western perspective. Well, what would Islam look like from an Eastern Taoist perspective? The questions we would ask are completely different. What seems strange or what seems familiar is completely different. And I think even, you know, how Islam looks from Jewish eyes is very different than how Islam looks from Christian eyes. And so maybe sometimes that would be an interesting exercise is to, you know, to do it that way.
Thank you.
Sir? Two-part question, and the second question obviously would be informed by your answer to the first question. Do you believe that the preservation and the authority of tradition is a esoteric or a corporate enterprise, number one? Follow-up question to that then is, depending on how you answer that, do you think the current modern and postmodern reality that we live in is threatening the preservation of the particular tradition that you're representing?
You want to take that one?
No.
Can
you restate that?
Just to give do you want me to restate it?
I just don't understand what you're asking.
Well,
I'm sorry.
The whole broad discussion here is about tradition and how do how do multiple orthodoxies, your view of reality versus your co-panelist view of reality, how do we interact? Mm-hmm. So the question is the whole nature of tradition is authority for us? I'm saying at least as represented, is the preservation of that tradition as authority, is that something that's preserved by the elite, or is that something that's done in a broader cultural context by the masses? And I guess it's obviously, if it's by the elite, I think the second question becomes mute. But if it's something that's preserved within a broader cultural context, then how does a modern, postmodern world, which I think at least probably more postmodern than modern, being ahistorical, how do you preserve that tradition and the authority of that tradition in the reality that we live in?
Well, from my point of view, the traditions, those legacies in the Muslim world, religious traditions, the biggest threat to them in the modern age is probably the printing press, or let's put it this way, the newspaper, and then the radio, and then the internet. And the reason for that is that with, the newspaper and these other means of communication, then anyone who can write well becomes an authority. So what's happened in the Muslim world? Of course, the Muslim world doesn't really have what could be called corporate structures, like a church. So, you know, tradition in the Muslim world very much relies on human beings, like one person, one man or woman, transmitting to another. Traditionally, they had certain authority because they were the ones who controlled, the venues of discourse. But, you know, with these modern developments in communication, they're really almost silent. And I spoke with one of the great sheikhs of Al-Azhar, who is Sheikh Ali Jumu'ah. We visited him. I had lunch with him last summer. He's, I think, one of the greatest figures in the Muslim world today, superb and a true scholar, you know, of the tradition. And he told me, he said, how do you speak the truth in sound bites? He said, I can't express the truth in sound bites. Can you help me? And I can't do it either, right? So, but you see, then you have Ali Jumu'ah, who is a really, excellent representative of the tradition in the best way. And then you have people, like, for example, the Islamists, the radicals. I mean, how do they get their authority? From the internet. They get it from publications and things like that. And because they can say things usually in a very simple way, they can communicate because they have very simple language and they speak in a very categorical way. This is Islam. Islam says this. You know, Islam doesn't say anything. It has to be interpreted. So I would say that in the Muslim world, that's the big issue. And, Richard Bullitt, who at Columbia, who's done excellent studies of the spread of Islam in history, have conversion. Usually conversion took about 200 to 300 years. You know, he divides Islamic history into four periods. He said Islamic history can fall into four periods of 400 years. And so the first period is the classical period. Then you have the breakup of the state, the principalities. Then you have the gunpowder empires. And then you have the modern age. And so we're halfway through. And he said that the modern age, which begins around 1800, is essentially the age of authority. That who will be the authority in this faith? And he says it'll probably take another 200 years to do that. Now, myself, as a member of the American Muslim community, which I'm extremely proud to be a member of, because our community has tremendous potential in terms of wealth and intellect and education. We're one of the most educated communities in the United States. Working with the young people like yourself, like Dr. Mattson, who's not. But we're not the same age, but anyway. But, working with them, you're really dealing with talented people. And in my view, we can bring the tradition back to life. That's what I believe. In the United States, we can actually make that a tradition of civilization, where scholars are real scholars. And in the Muslim world today, basically, it's very difficult to do that, almost impossible to do that.
Can you elaborate on that in terms of how you think that is possible in the American context? In Latin, when you said the biggest threat is mass media.
Go to my website.
And
what is that again? Go to my website.
Okay. So one of the things we talked about this morning, and I know, Maimon, you weren't there, was that in Judaism, that authority is in... authority looks different in different movements. So that's one thing. And I think that there's a really complex relationship between the elite, what I would say the rabbis, and the masses in Hebrew, the amcha, like the regular people. And I think that's complicated. And I do think that the masses have a lot of power, much more than sometimes the rabbis would like. And that they are really shaping tradition. The other thing that's happening is that leaders themselves are also really challenging tradition. One of the most significant changes, I think, is the role of gays and lesbians in Jewish life. The Reform movement, Reconstructionist movement, and as of last December, the Conservative movement are now all ordaining gay and lesbian rabbis. And the statements are different, but that means that 85% of the American Jewish community belongs to movements that could have a gay or lesbian rabbi. And that did not come from, you know, a bunch of rabbis sitting around, but ultimately, but it came from the masses really pushing it, and students at the rabbinical seminaries really pushing for it. And I think that's a really interesting example. I don't see it as a threat at all. I think it's really, what it shows me is that there are Jews who are committed enough to Judaism that they're willing to be involved enough to make change. And I think that that's really positive. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to have to stop here. I want to thank our panelists for a wonderful session.